AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. The people of Japan are in mourning, as is the mother of Kenji Goto. A video said to show Goto's killing by the Islamic State has been posted online, causing grief and anger in Japan and worry in Jordan about a fighter pilot who's also being held captive. AP correspondent Karen Loeb reports from Amman that the Jordanian government is still willing to swap an al-Qaeda prisoner for the pilot if the radical group shows proof he's still alive.
The Jordanian government has renewed an offer to swap an al-Qaeda prisoner for a fighter pilot held by the Islamic State group. This offer came a day after a video purportedly showed that the militants beheaded a Japanese hostage, Kenji Goto.
Islamic extremists have attacked the largest city in northeast Nigeria from four fronts overnight. Scores of frightened residents are streaming out of the city of 2 million people. This is the third assault on that city by Boko Haram, which claims it as its birthplace. Bobby Christina Brown, only child of late singer and entertainer Whitney Houston, was found unresponsive, face down in a bathtub yesterday, and rushed to a hospital in Atlanta suburb. Police say she was found by her husband and a friend who performed CPR as they called police. A police spokeswoman says the 21-year-old was alive when she was brought to the hospital. A family representative did not immediately return messages seeking comment. Getting ready for the Super Bowl.
I'm trying to make some buffalo wings with sriracha barbecue sauce.
Potato chips, some big sausages.
Lots of beer.
Dietitian Susan Burke-March says people need to watch out what they eat and drink before, during, and after this evening's game.
Keep your hands full of things that you don't want to eat, like sip on a, you know, club soda, and hold a plate. And fill it up with as much vegetables as he possibly can.
This is AP Radio News. Federal regulators are putting together the first ever rules on payday loans to help keep cash-strapped borrowers from falling into a cycle of high-rate debt. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says state laws governing the $46 billion lending industry often fall short. Annual percentage rates on such loans typically exceed 300%. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio says he's moved on from his rift with police.
While Mayor de Blasio acknowledged much work remains to repair hard feelings with police, he told the Associated Press he has regained the footing to move on. He also shared with AP how he handled the controversy, including taking the high road and focusing on families of the officers gunned down in December, having Cardinal Timothy Dolan and Police Commissioner William Bratton speak for the administration, and finally avoiding verbal warfare with the police unions, hoping instead the passage of time would dissipate the rank and file's anger. Julie Walker, New York.
I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
Hey, Mom, why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1T1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
In the small town of Elmira, New York, a boy was born into an all-American family. The odds of him achieving his dream in the fashion industry? 1 in 23 million. The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 68. I am Tommy Hilfiger, and my family is affected by autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
Okay, so 5 tacos of cheese and a large soda, that's $10,012. Please drive around.
Wait, 10,000 what?
It's obvious you're buzzed and driving.
I've only had a few. I'm fine.
Yeah, the food's $12, but getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Please drive around. Actually, just park and come in.
Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of Offutt Kerman in Tysons Corner, Virginia. This is your host, Les Smolin. With my co-host, Mike.
Mike Mercurio.
Mark Cohen.
Great. We have a great lineup of guests for you today. Mark, would you please go through the lineup for us?
Yeah. Les, we have a great lineup. It's first up is Ben Asnawi, the president and CEO of Talatech. Next, we have Len Forkas, the president and CEO of Milestone Communications. Then we'll have Tim Rubin, CEO and president of USSI, and we're going to end with Prachi Devadas, founder and CEO of Synergy Enterprises.
Thanks, Mark. First up is going to be Bon Asnawi, president and CEO of Talatech. Welcome, Bon. Bon, what is Talatech?
Talatech is a small woman-owned business. It's specialized in IT security, risk management, and policies and compliance.
Mm-hmm. And then how'd you get started with them?
About 9 years ago, I decided that I would like to explore and looked at opportunities in the market and looked like in the federal government there's a tremendous need for help in the compliance and the security areas. And I had background, my last job before that was with McAfee as a security engineer, so I've learned a lot in that and I understood the needs in the market and I thought I could go on my own.
And how big or small is the company?
We're about 10, 12 people.
Mm-hmm. And you said you have a background in this, you said.
Right. My degree is in computer science and control and systems engineering, and I've always worked as a, you know, worked from being a help desk all the way through working through a director of security for a small firm in D.C.
And what do you think prepared you in your background for doing what you're doing now? Whether it's the starting of the firm, obviously I get the connection from a technical standpoint, but starting a firm?
I think what triggered the I would call it the straw that broke the camel's back was the desire to have some semblance of life-work balance. After having my second child, I just decided that I did not want to have an 8-to-5 job and I needed to be there for my family. And yet I had a desire to continue to work and I needed the income as well.
So you gave up the security of an 8-hour job for what?
For a 24/7 job that is always unknown and always fun.
Yeah. What was the hardest part about making that transition?
The uncertainty. The uncertainty and living a day by day. It's a complete different mindset from knowing that you have a paycheck that you would receive to. Mm-hmm. And then as I evolved and I have people who are working for me, there's that challenge of making sure that you are taking care of your folks as well. So it's not just me and my family. It's the extended family of the firm.
Let's go back a little bit. Where did you grow up?
I was born in the United States, so I grew up here. My first years of my life were here, but then I went back to Iraq where my parents are from, and I grew up there for a good portion of my life.
Was that a hard adjustment to make from being born here and then having to go back there?
I was young enough to adjust and adapt. So.
How old were you?
I was 6 years old.
6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Brothers, sisters?
I'm the oldest of three sisters.
Oldest of three, and they all went back together, all of you, or just you?
There were only two of us at the time, so we all went back. My dad finished his studies, and he went back. And
what was dad doing?
He had gotten his PhD, his master's from Stanford, PhD from St. Louis University.
So he was educated here in the U.S.?
Right. He was getting his degrees here with my mom, and they went back to Iraq.
And you said something about what he was doing for a living. What was that?
Oh, my dad was a professor at the university in Baghdad, and I grew up just knowing that my dad was a professor and in life and at home and at work.
So you got to see him a lot?
Yeah.
And you also said he was a seismologist. That was his educational background?
Correct.
And a teacher, obviously, in academia.
Right.
What do you remember about him most growing up?
Our school mattered tremendously. Our success mattered. And good enough was never good enough. So we always had to be better than... There was no okay.
So he was pretty driven in making sure that you people never just rested on laurels, as we say?
Absolutely. And again, being the firstborn, you have to make your parents proud. My mom was no less driven, or she was also had a degree in mathematics. And so being, I think, one of my father's disappointments till this day that I never pursued a master's degree or a PhD. And
really? You think he's disappointed?
Well, you know, he would have loved for me to do that. And I decided that I wanted to do more of being practical. And I think the aspect of engineering also is different than science in my mind, that you would, engineering, you have to practice the theory and make it happen. Mm-hmm. So it's a practical implementation of what you learn. And I enjoyed that better than studying. And
is he surprised, you think, by your success?
Oh, no. I think he expects it.
Really? That must be difficult to grow up under that circumstance, or is that just my assumption?
I don't know. It's part of who I am. I don't think I look at it as difficult. It's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Was that hard? I mean, we were talking in the green room earlier just about, you know, the cultural transitions that you have to make growing up here in the United States, growing up in Iraq, especially under the circumstances you've described, and then also being the oldest. I mean, it's a lot of burden. It's a big responsibility, I suspect.
Every day is figuring out how to carry that responsibility and to be true to myself and to the expectations of everybody else around me. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as you become a mother, you have that same notion that you need to, your kids are going to look up to you. And then you own a business and you have people who work for you, and you would always want to be true to them and considerate and support them as well. So. Mm-hmm.
Actually, I'd like to take you back to Baghdad. You were living there when the U.S. invaded Kuwait, Gulf War I, I guess. What? How old were you then, and what were you going through?
I had a job, and I had what I thought was a life that I was going through, and it just all came to a very abrupt halt, and life stopped, and there were no jobs, nobody had anywhere to go, and we just waited there until the war ended. It was about 3 months of nothing. No electricity, no water, no transportation, no communication. It was just a very unique experience.
It's an interesting word, unique. Some people would probably say, I have no idea what people would say, but it was unique in the way you saw it. How do you rebound from something like that?
I don't know. To an extent, we probably carry it with us, and it is part of who we are and how we perceive life and challenges and opportunities. I think I was able to take the positive out of that and learn how to turn it into a positive. So it's a driver and a motivation. And no matter how bad things get, I would always remember the moment when you're sitting there waiting for the bombs, and you think, okay, this is not too bad. So it keeps things in perspective.
How do you then think that experience catapulted you into your current situation? I mean, what did you learn from that you take to this current business?
Well, so if you think about it, the concept of losing everything, which is you don't have money, you don't have a job, and I had decided to come to the United States. I had an opportunity to you know, I was one of the lucky ones, right? So a lot of my peers, my colleagues, my friends, even family members don't have that opportunity to come to the United States and start all over. So I was determined to make the best out of that and start all over. And in one way, it's a driver because you don't want to go back. You absolutely want to look forward to better opportunity. And at the same time, it keeps things in perspective. Like I said, you know, how bad can it get? You know, let's say you lost your job. Let's say you didn't win that contract. Let's say you're in debt a few thousand dollars. all these things, just remember what you came from, and it seems okay.
So it puts things in an entirely different perspective when you can see, well, it could be this bad,
right,
but it's not that bad.
Right.
That's interesting. That's kind of resilience is what I hear in that.
Yes, I mean, that's one way to describe it.
Desire
not to fail, certainly, and try new things.
Is that drive, is that desire something that you think accounts for how you're being successful as a leader of a company?
I think it's a huge component of it. I mean, you think about it in business, there is the element of luck, clearly, and you have to have that. But there's the being driven and being persistent, if you will. You fail 10,000 times and you will win one time out of that. So it's just a matter of just keeping at it.
Mm-hmm. If you had a piece of advice for anybody out there that's listening to this around your experiences that you think they need to appreciate most, what would it be?
Well, I mean, you have to have passion and you have to really want to be successful. And I don't know if you can even quantify that and to what extent is your degree of passion or desire to succeed and what is it that you want to do. But you really absolutely need to have that. And again, I don't know if it's something that you could qualify easily.
Thank you, Bon. Bon, what's the website address?
It's talatech.com.
Thank you. Bon, we've been listening to an interview here with Bon Sanawi, President and CEO of Talatech. And don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment, right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining me for this segment is Doug Kay, who is a principal with a firm called Offit Kerman. What is Offit Kerman, Doug?
Offit Kerman is a full-service law firm in the Mid-Atlantic region with offices from Philadelphia all the way down to Tysons Corner, Virginia, where I work.
Right. And you're a lawyer with the firm?
I'm a lawyer with the firm.
What practice area do you specialize in?
I mostly do work in commercial litigation, although I also do work in doing criminal defense and personal injury, anything that gets me to trial.
Anything that gets you to trial. Well, why do your customers appreciate you?
I think they appreciate me because I am a careful and sympathetic listener, and I try to offer concrete solutions to their most vexing legal problems.
Well, give us an example. Do you have, without mentioning specifics, a recent example of where you were really good at this? How about your favorite client up till now, without getting into two particulars there?
Well, I represented a fellow who was in a commercial lease. And the landlord was determined to make him pay more than he should have been paying. And we had to go to court, and we had to go all the way through trial. And the client really appreciated the effort, and we got an excellent result for the client. And that was very satisfying. And since then, he's been talking me up all over town, so I can't thank him enough.
Yeah. What's the best part of practicing law for you?
I would say that it is taking people through difficult circumstances when they think they don't have any options and trying to find a good solution for them.
Right. What's the website address for the law firm?
www.offitkerman.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Doug Kay, who's the principal with Offit Kerman. This is Peter Schwartz, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-hosts, Mark Cohn and Mike Mercurio. Our next guest is Len Forkas, President and CEO of Milestone Communications. Welcome, Len.
Oh, thanks, Les.
Len, what is Milestone Communications?
Milestone Communications is a tower company that I created. We build and own cell phone towers.
So you created this. How long ago?
In the year 2000.
And how big or small is it?
We've got a dozen employees, and we're building toward a $200 million market value over the next 5 years.
That's pretty impressive. Yeah. Why is that important?
Well, we've got a great model. We partner with schools and local governments to build towers on their real estate. We design them so they blend in with the environment, and we provide revenue streams for the municipalities, but also we can solve a really tough problem, which is how to get great coverage in communities and residential neighborhoods.
Yeah, something you said in the green room was interesting, that you know, I think of these towers as just steel structures where we hang all these transponders and everything else on there, but you do something a little different. What is that and why?
Well, we design them so they blend in with the environment. There's a huge problem in providing coverage in residential communities. So we partner with municipalities throughout the Mid-Atlantic states and provide revenue through the leases that the companies like Verizon and T-Mobile pay.
Yeah, you had an interesting phrase that you used to explain what you're doing with, because you've kind of taken two different careers and married them together.
Yeah, I was a real estate developer for most of my career, and found that it was a great opportunity to be able to design this in a way. Towers are really vertical real estate. And that was the nature. I used to be an architect, so I care about what things look like in the environment, so I wanted to design a solution that would be visually attractive.
So is there any way that I can connect for our audience how being an architect and having interest in real estate, especially vertical real estate, kind of come together for you?
Well, for me, it was all about, you know, making things in the built environment look the best they can. But I think in the end, we provide a great solution.
Mm-hmm. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
And what were Mom and Dad doing?
My dad was an independent salesperson, and my mom took care of myself and my three siblings.
So you have three brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters and a younger brother.
And where are you in the pecking order?
I was the second.
The second. What's it like being the second out of four?
Well, you know, just I don't know if there's really any difference. I was the oldest boy, you know, just growing up in Cleveland when I grew up, you know, we were all very, very independent. We all, you know, were able to do what we wanted. Neither of my parents graduated from high school, but they had a very, very hard, strong work ethic. And since my dad was his own boss, he taught us to be independent and do for ourselves.
Yeah, you had mentioned that he was selling some kind of equipment, check writing equipment?
Yeah, I used to sell a machine called a check writer. It's a machine, if you get a cashier's check and the amount is stamped out, that's what he sold. And when I was 15, he taught me how to sell check writers. And I used to take the bus after school downtown Cleveland with a demonstration kit.
By yourself?
Yeah. And I'd go to the top of the tallest building in Cleveland, and I'd start cold calling and knocking on doors until I got to the bottom.
What did he do? He gave you a piece of equipment. He said, get out there?
He gave me the seat, taught me how to sell, and gave me a presentation. And so I would go out, and I'd make a couple $100 if I sold one. So some days I'd take a bus back, and if I made a sale, I'd take a taxi home.
So what was that like? I mean, 15 years old, dad sends you down to the big city with a piece of equipment that he makes his living off of, gives you the sales presentation.
Well, he taught me that, you know, you treat everybody the same, whether you're talking to the guy that owns a gas station or a guy that runs a bank. You treat everybody the same way. And don't be afraid to talk to people. Don't be afraid to knock on the door. Don't, because someone says no, don't be rejected by it. So I learned at a very, very early age to be resilient, to bounce back from rejection, and to not take it personally.
How do you do that at 15? I mean, I couldn't internalize that and figure that thing out.
Well, I tried to date, and I got a lot of no's, so I had to learn to keep keep asking. So that was a big part of it. But no, I think so often sometimes, you know, in our lives, the fear of rejection is such a huge driver. Uh-huh. And I was blessed that I grew up in a family where we all learned that if you make a mistake, you pick up and you keep going.
What was Mom doing?
Well, my mom raised all of us, was home full-time, but she was a huge volunteer in our community. She ran the PTA. She was always involved with the Church Guild and was very, very active in helping others. And that was just part of our DNA when we were kids to do mm-hmm. that.
What did you take away from her?
Well, the thing from my mom is that, you know, she made it on her own steam as well. She raised four beautiful kids, and hard work and education was really the DNA that made her tick.
Mm-hmm. So the thing that actually I think some of in our listening audience really want to understand is, so here you are, 15 years old, you're out there making money selling this check writing equipment, 15 years old. You're taking all the money and you're banking it, right?
Well, you know, I spent some of it on things that I liked. But I think that what I really loved about it was that I didn't have to rely on anyone else for money to do things that I wanted to do.
Why was that important?
Well, because I didn't want to feel tethered to someone else. And like I bought my first bicycle with my own money. When I went to college my first year, I paid for all of it, everything.
Dad wasn't going to pay for this?
No, it was all there, but I just wanted to prove I could do it.
Why?
Because to me, I had great amount of pride associated with being independent. And not having to rely on others, and to be able to make it myself.
And does that come from dad?
You know, and I think the other thing, too, is that when I grew up, I mean, you know, we had one bathroom in our house. I mean, we lived in a modest, you know, community. We weren't poor by any stretch, but you know, where I grew up, everyone was like that. Everyone had jobs. We all had paper routes. We all worked at gas stations. I worked at a nursing home. I did laundry, you know, and so.
You did a lot of things.
I did a lot of things, and I stamped steel. I lied about my age to get my job when I was in high school. I worked at a night shift in a factory, but you just did these things because, you know, it wasn't so much that it was expected, mm-hmm. but I just wanted to be able to save. I saved money to go to college, obviously, is I think the answer to your question.
Yeah.
But it was just important for me to be able to know that I could always work.
How does that show up today for you?
Well, I think today it's just so valuable to know that is not be afraid of failing. And not being afraid of things that you don't know. I mean, all those jobs I had, I had no idea how to do any of those jobs. So it taught me very early age to be able to take risks.
But the risk back then isn't the same as it is when you're now running a company or when you're trying to get to $200 million in a valuation.
Yeah, well, I think that it's clear to me that you have to be willing to make mistakes. You have to be willing to recover from them. I mean, that's a core value of my company, my business. I always tell my team, and I've got the most amazing people on my team, is that, you know, I would much rather have you make 80 decisions right out of 100 than make 10 perfect decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so forgiveness, forgiving when you make mistakes. Mistakes are opportunities to get better.
You see it that way?
Absolutely.
Do the folks in your company see it that way too?
I hope, yeah, I believe so.
Do you encourage them to actually take risks and make mistakes and learn from it, or what?
Everybody on my team's a quarterback. They own their jobs. They have a broad span of things that they can do, and I think that's just the DNA of our organization.
Huh.
Your passion for business clearly comes through. What other passions do you have?
Well, you know, I love exercising. I had a life experience that happened to me 12 years ago. My son Matt was diagnosed with leukemia, and the toughest time of his life, he couldn't go back to school, and I saw how painful it was for him. And so we were able to figure out a way to connect him through his class using webcams before Skype, and it made such a difference in his recovery that I was able to fund it. The growth to help other kids by running ultra marathons, doing Ironman triathlons.
You were doing all this.
Yeah, and I ended up 3 years ago, I did a bike race across the country where I raced 3,000 miles in 11 days in a race called Race Across America, and I raised over $350,000 for the charity. And so I was able to take my passion, which was exercise, which, by the way, helped me greatly when he was going through treatment to cope with the stress of his illness. And I was able to turn that and convert that into something that's now helping, you know, we helped 360 kids last year in 37 states.
That's amazing. You said you wrote a book about that or something related to that?
Yeah, it's called What Spins a Wheel, and I also speak publicly about the leadership lessons, about what happens when you can bring together. I had 11 people volunteer to help me during the race. What happens when you have 11 people that believe in their mission, that forgive each other, learn to honor each other's roles, and to be able to treat each other like family.
That's amazing. Lance, great story. I'm sure we could get into even further, but we're running out of time. So what's the website address?
The website for my company is milestonecommunications.com, and the website for the charity is hopecam.org.
We've been speaking with Len Forkas, President and CEO of Milestone Communications. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be right back in a moment after this business spotlight. This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us today is Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn & Burnett, a law firm. Mark, welcome. What is Cohn & Burnett?
We are a law firm that focuses on trusts and estates. So we do wills, trusts, powers of attorney, estate planning, and estate administration.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the founder and the senior partner.
So what does it mean to be a senior partner?
Well, it means that in our case, I'm the thought leader, the visionary, the one who tries to figure out where we're headed. I'm not the managing partner who runs the day-to-day operations.
Okay, and what makes Cohn & Burnett so special?
We are, first of all, focused on taking care of our clients and just on their estate planning and administration. And I think we're one of the first firms in the area to introduce a fixed fee for doing estate planning.
Interesting. And what do they really appreciate about you and the company, your clients, that is?
You know, the clients tell me that they just love the experience. They are very comfortable and confident that their needs are being met here, and they enjoy working with us.
Hmm. And who Or what is your perfect client, if you will?
Our perfect client is anybody who cares about what's going to happen to them when they can no longer take care of themselves or their family.
Mm-hmm. And what is it you actually enjoy most about the work?
You know, talking to the clients, that's the part. I could turn over all of the work to other attorneys here, but I hold on to the first part, which is meeting the clients, talking to them, getting to know them, getting to understand where they're, what they need and what they're looking for.
That's great. What's the website for Cohen & Burnett?
CohenAndBurnett.com, all spelled out, the A-N-D in between there.
Thank you, Mark. We've been speaking with Mark Cohen, founder of Cohen & Burnett. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-hosts, Mike Mercurio and Mark Cohen. Our next guest, Tim Rubin, CEO and President of USSI. Welcome, Tim. Tim, what is USSI?
USSI is a large janitorial, commercial janitorial company. We do business in the Mid-Atlantic area and throughout the state of Florida.
Mm-hmm. And how big or small is it?
$30 million in sales, roughly 1,400 employees.
And did you start the company, get hired? How'd that happen?
The company's started in 1912, so I can barely remember the
1912.
Beginning of it.
Yeah. It's been around a long time.
It has.
So when did you sign on?
1994. So Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day.
A sweetheart deal.
Did you get a good one? In hindsight?
21 years later, yes.
Yeah. So what were you hired on to do?
I joined as the Senior Vice President of Sales and Marketing.
Mm-hmm. And what prepared you for that?
I had almost 14-year career at IBM in sales and marketing.
So IBM, technology, contract cleaning. There's a story there. We'll get there in a moment. But you are not the head of sales and marketing. You're the CEO.
I'm the CEO now, yes.
And so how'd that transition happen?
About 4 years after I joined the company, the owner of the company and chairman of the board said to the then CEO and the gentleman who hired me that he should go play golf and I should take over as CEO.
Why? What do you think he saw in you that said you were the best guy to do that?
Good question. I think probably the fact that we'd been had some success in the sales and marketing arena, and I'd spent some time with him. I think he had some trust and confidence that I would always do the right thing.
And what did you think you had that actually said, I can do this? Because it's, you know, there's no guarantee you'd be successful, I suspect.
Right. I had been in a leadership or management role in a number of organizations before joining USSI. I mean, even going back to high school, so pretty much a lifetime of being in leadership and management positions.
Where'd you grow up?
Wisconsin, born and raised in a small town.
Born and raised Wisconsin.
Certified cheesehead.
Brothers, sisters?
Three younger brothers, all taller.
So, all taller. There's
all taller.
A story there? I mean, the audience can't see you. But.
Well, that's true. I'm more or less 6 feet, but we all played sports, and the youngest was the basketball player. So
what's it like being the oldest out of four? Four boys in particular.
Four
it must
boys.
Be pretty competitive,
four
right?
Four boys and five counting my father, at least the way my mother counted. Yes, being the oldest, you're the great experiment. So certainly more restrictions and such from mom and dad.
So the experiment with a leash?
With a leash, yes, and with a short leash.
Uh-huh.
So relatively speaking, my brothers got away with murder compared to what I did growing up. But
was that something that restricted you from experimenting, or did you think it kind of gave you the opportunity to do that but within limits?
You know, the thing that I really remember vividly is the countdown to going away to college. And I had a calendar, and I would cross off the days on the calendar because I really wanted to prove that when I was on my own, I could function just fine. And so I earned enough in the way of scholarship money and then working various jobs to put myself through college.
What was the first paying job you had as a kid?
I, in high school, was bagging and carrying out groceries in a grocery store.
What'd you do with the money?
Saved it for college.
Did you have to pay your way through?
I didn't. I mean, it wasn't a requirement, but I really wanted the no strings attached approach. So, and I was bent on going to a small school in a warm climate, more than 1,000 miles away from home, with a high academic standing. So, if I paid my way, I could make my own decisions on that.
Mom and Dad agree with that? Or take a little bit of persuasion, maybe?
They agreed for the most part. I think, though, at the beginning of my junior year, when I bought a motorcycle to drive from
junior year of high school,
junior
or college?
Year of college, yeah, to ride from Wisconsin down to Houston with a suitcase bungee corded on the back, that they would never see me again, and that I perhaps had taken this do my own thing just a little too far. But
so, what was that like for you and for them?
For me, it was. Since it was a single-cylinder Ducati 160 motorcycle, it was 3 days of nonstop vibration. I think I'm still vibrating to this day. But for them, I think they certainly had the realization that their son was pretty much going to do whatever he put his mind to do. And but I mean, to their credit, they were extremely supportive, and and to this day, my mother's been widowed for over 30 years, but she's 88 years old, still lives alone in Wisconsin. I still call her every day to check in on her.
Hmm. She's surprised by your success?
Not really. I mean, I was a good student in high school, and you know, president of the student senate, and I've been fortunate to do pretty well at whatever I've done.
Where do you think you get the drive to do it on your own, be your own man?
You know, that's a good question. Perhaps it comes from being the oldest, knowing that you're the experiment, and that you're the role model for your brothers.
That's a lot of pressure, though, too, isn't it?
You know, it goes with the territory, I guess. But I've got great relationships with my brothers to this day. So, in fact, we refer to each other the way the presidents do, so 1, 2, 3, and 4. So number 3 came out from Long Beach this summer, and we went up to Cooperstown, New York, for the Baseball Hall of Fame weekend. Just had a fabulous time together.
Mm-hmm.
I want to change the subject a little bit, and I'm curious, all the businesses you've been in, and you've been running as CEO of a fairly good-sized company now for years, what's the single most important value you think that you contribute?
I really think that integrity, that doing what you say you're going to do, that there can be no discrepancy between what you say and what you do, and certainly as a CEO and as a CEO of with many employees, you realize that people don't listen to you as much as they watch you, and so whatever you do day in, day out, that's what they really take as being the real you. And say one thing and do another, they lose all respect for you very quickly. And so I think that's the most important thing.
Where does that come from?
Definitely from my parents.
Mom or Dad?
Both. Whether you want to call it the Midwestern values I'm not sure. But my father worked for the IRS for 31 years.
Dad worked for the IRS.
Was a field agent, padlocked businesses, collected.
He must have been really welcome.
Real popular guy, yeah. But the fact is that he was the embodiment of the Dale Carnegie, don't criticize, don't complain, don't condemn. He took the course when I was a youngster, and I always thought he should be teaching the course, not taking it.
So, why did you say that? Why did you think he should be teaching it instead of taking it?
People loved him. People respected him. And it really didn't matter whether he was delivering a message that they probably didn't want to hear. They knew he was genuine and that his word was golden.
What was the hardest part about that for you as a kid growing up, being the son of the IRS field officer?
Oh, it really, other than maybe the butt of a few jokes, really, it was no issue for me. Mm-hmm. Again, he was well-liked and well-respected, and certainly the embodiment of the golden rule.
Yeah. What about Mom? What'd you take from her?
Mom, bless her heart, raised four boys, meaning us four sons, and my father, she counted as the fifth. Mm-hmm. She didn't go beyond high school in terms of formal education, but yeah. To this day, is a sponge in terms of learning new things every day, whether it's television, radio. CNBC is her favorite station, and when I call her back in Wisconsin to check in on her each night, I learn something from her.
Is that important in what you do, just to be learning?
Absolutely. There's no way that you can know it all, and even when I was younger and thought I did know it all, I quickly learned that I was wrong about that. So that every day you have to learn from the people who work with you and your customers, and that's critical. It reminds me of in high school when I was leaving a job in the grocery store, and the manager said to me, when you hired on here, I didn't think you were too bright because you asked so many questions. I figured you just didn't get it. But then I realized that you were asking all those questions for a reason, and I think that's critical.
Thanks, Tim. Tim, what's the website?
www.ussiclean.com.
We've been speaking with Tim Rubin, CEO and President of USSI. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
Here for today's Business Spotlight is Chris Vannetti, Vice President of Contract and Project Staffing Services at Hire Strategy. Chris, what is Hire Strategy?
Hire Strategy is a D.C. Metro-based professional services and staffing firm. Specializing in information technology placements as well as HR and administrative, sales and marketing, and accounting and finance.
And what do clients love about working with Hire Strategy?
We take an old school approach to staffing. And what I mean by that is, back in the day before social media and email, it was all about people. And we're one of the few and last firms in this marketplace, probably nationwide, that really interviews in person, takes the time to know their candidates, and 100% takes the time to know their clients, their pushes and pulls, the positives and negatives, to make the right match. So it's truly a consultative approach.
Mm-hmm. What do employees love about working for Hire Strategy?
It's definitely our culture. And the employees that work for us, I think they would all to a person say, we believe in leadership, not management. And that's one of our key mottos. And leading people is a definite thing that we like to do, and we like to do it often.
So what does that mean for a new employee? They get to be a leader?
They can get to be a leader, but they're a leader of their own practice, of their own business. We allow them to be entrepreneurial. We allow them to make their own decisions, and we're there to help them along the way, correct them if need be. But motivation and leadership is the one way that we think that people are going to excel with us.
What do you love most about your job?
I love that I get the opportunity to be a leader and to be entrepreneurial and work with a great bunch of people. And a great group of executives along with myself, so it's a great place to be.
What's the website?
The website is www.hirestrategy.com.
Thank you for listening to this Business Spotlight. Joining us for this Business Spotlight is Wes Burnett, partner at Opti4. Wes, what is Opti4?
Opti4 is a securities firm that integrates legal, tax, and financial and risk in order to offer optimal results for clients.
Who's your perfect client?
Perfect client is someone who actually would like to combine services, make their life simpler, and is very family-oriented. Our firm itself is very family-oriented. We love helping families take care of their own, and that can be multi-generational.
So what would a family need when they would come to you?
Typically, what they're doing is trying to simplify their personal life by trying to have somebody else worry about their legal and their tax and financial affairs and present them with solutions rather than questions.
Solutions rather than questions. So give us an example of a good solution.
A good solution is something that results, for example, in the lowest tax bill, the greatest savings, and taking care of the values important to the family, like saving for college for children or grandchildren or something along those lines.
So what do you enjoy most about your work?
My clients. Although a second place close would be my staff, because I recruit very specifically people who have the same values as our clients. So we truly are very involved with our clients' lives, and they are family to us.
What about your family? Are they in the business too?
No. Although there's certainly plenty of lawyers and financial advisors and so on in the business. But no, they all have their own lives, and we're very pleased, quite frankly, with that. I actually have a wife who's a teacher for 42 years, so I take a lot of my values from her.
What is the website?
Optifor.com, OPTIFOUR.com.
Thanks for listening to this Business Spotlight.
We're back. And you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-hosts, Mike Mercurio and Mark Cohn. And our next guest is Prachi Davidis, founder and CEO of Synergy Enterprises. Welcome, Prachi. Prachi, what is Synergy Enterprises?
First of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm delighted to be here. Synergy is a woman-owned small business located in Silver Spring, Maryland. We are primarily a federal government contractor.
And how big or small?
We are about 120 employees, and our focus is mainly in public education, public health.
And did they hire you? Did you start this
thing? No, I started it.
So when did you start it?
I started it in May of 2003, but I had a non-compete, so I couldn't actually actively sell the company to say.
What do you mean you had a non-compete?
Because the work that Synergy does is similar to the predecessor employer of mine. They wanted me not to be able to sell the, you know, work against them, in other words. So there was a non-compete.
So why did you leave what would for most people be the comfort of a great job and go out on your own?
I think, like I've said to a lot of my well-wishers and some naysayers, I had to go ahead and prove the naysayers wrong. And I needed to make a difference on my own, because I was quite exhausted of bringing in lots of business into my previous companies and then conveniently being shown the door.
What do you mean you were shown the door? If you're being successful bringing business in, why would they show you the door?
I think that there are insecurities in all of us, and sometimes we let our insecurities get the better of better business judgment and better human relations. And I can't fault them for the decisions that they made, because that only egged me on to do something for myself and to prove that I could do things on my own.
So if you spent all that energy just kind of being angry at them for all they
Not at all. Not at all. I think anger is a very wasted emotion. I think in every situation, good or bad, there is something we can learn from, and something that prompts us to be better human beings and to do better.
So what happened is you were coming up against a glass wall, right?
That's right.
And having done that, you decided rather than go get another job, you would just create your own and compete.
Absolutely.
But what is it about you that led you to that decision? Because so many other people wouldn't go there. What's about you that's different?
I think I owe my entrepreneurship or skills for that to my husband and my son, because they've been my primary inspirations. My husband basically said, if you don't try things on your own, you will never be truly content, because you will always have this wanting, this longing that you didn't give it your all. So he said, you've got what you need to do. You've got the skill sets. You've got the relationships. And I will back you financially. And he basically, with no questions asked, decided to put the money forward because no bank would touch me with a barge pole, and decided to float the company. So I owe it to him, and I owe it to my son who has Asperger's. And I needed to be there for my son. So I needed to be my own entrepreneur, calling my own times.
Yeah, so what do you think your husband saw in you? I mean, that's a pretty risky move to encourage you to step out on the edge like that.
You know, my husband and I have known each other since I was 16 years old. And I remember very fondly he gave me a birthday card with a star on it and said, you should always reach for the stars. You have it in you. And he saw a spark that I think nobody, including myself, ever credited me for having, and I still don't think I have it. I just basically do my job. And I think, you know, being an entrepreneur, sometimes you have to look at it as you're an employee, but with a lot of debt and a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
And so when you have that focus that you got to do the right thing and you got to just be true to yourself and do right by people, whether they are your employees, your clients, or the general public, that eggs you on.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in India, was brought up in lots of different parts of India because my father was in the armed forces as a fighter pilot and commanding officer. So I moved from place to place, but I had my schooling in a lot of Catholic institutions. I went to convents because that's a very done thing in India. So I went there, and I came here when I was 20, 30 years ago, and have been here since.
So there's a lot to cover there, so let's see if we can get some of the things out that are really important. So Dad's a fighter pilot in the armed forces. He's taking you around the country because of his work. What's Mom doing?
My mom was a huge supporter of my dad, and as a armed forces commanding officer's wife, she had to take care of the family and also take care of the community. You know, we had lots of parties and lots of shindigs at our place, and she was a perfect organizer of those things with military precision, and was extremely charming and could communicate beautifully with everybody. And I think being a fantastic hostess is actually, you know, a skill. And on top of that, she is a very spiritual person, and I think I got that from her.
The spiritual part?
Yes.
Is that what enables you to be successful in the role that you play today as the leader of the company?
You know, I keep questioning what success really is, and I still haven't found the answer. So in a roundabout way to answer your question, I think, yes, I'm successful to that, but I'm successful because of my family and because of the team of people that I have. I wouldn't be where I am without them.
Really? I thought just entrepreneurs, you know, you just drive everything, and if it's not for you, it doesn't happen.
And no, you could be the primary rainmaker, which I was in the beginning, but your role is to really be able to build a team. You're like a glue that holds everyone together, and if the glue starts to unstick, everything's going to fall apart.
So who was the glue for you growing up?
The glue for me was my dad.
Your dad?
Yes, my dad, certainly.
I thought he was up in you know, flying jets. How does he get to be the glue?
Well, he was a man of very few words, but when he did speak, he really gave you pearls of wisdom. And also, he was a very succinct, no-nonsense kind of person, and just basically said, respect yourself, work hard, and be true to yourself.
And are you?
For the most part. I think it's a very tall order. It seems rather simple philosophy in life, but when rubber hits the road and you really have to be true to yourself, you know, we are all human. There are many challenges and many different scenarios you're thrown into, and you have to introspectively decide what is right for you.
So what was the most difficult thing for you kind of growing up, since you grew up in India, and then you come over to the United States of America? It's a different world, isn't it?
Yes, in 1986, certainly it was. Now it's getting flatter and a little more manageable.
Thomas Friedman got the plug.
So the most difficult thing was that I was the youngest of three kids. My older sister and brother were academically extremely proficient, debate captains, class captains, prefix, and all that. And I was very, very mediocre, to say the least. My parents were constantly concerned if I'd pass my exams. And I was not even considered at all good-looking or a good communicator. And because in India, there is, you know, you've got to be fair and light-eyed, and my brother and sister both are very fair, and they have green eyes from my mother. And so I took after my dad, you know, ordinary, brown-eyed, brown-haired little thing. And
that's true. We can see that.
Yeah, so basically it was very challenging because everybody said, who is she going to marry? Because that was the biggest thing in India.
That
who
was what they thought would be your ticket to...
Yeah. My goodness, how is she going to manage?
So how did you overcome that stereotype?
Well, like I said, my husband saw something in me, and he is one good-looking, fantastically charming, highly accomplished individual, if I may say so. At the age of 15, he was the youngest photojournalist accredited by the White House. So, you know...
At the age of 15?
15. And if he could choose me as his life partner and saw something in me, well, I must have been special. So I had to make sure that I was not going to let him down.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. But at 15, and you knew, you said earlier, you met when you were 16.
Yes. He's about 5.5 years older than I am, and he came to India.
So you met in India?
I met him in India, yes, in 1984.
Were you married 83. In India?
Well, actually, I came on a fiancé visa, so we got married here, and it was very strange circumstances.
So of all the places you could have gone in the world, why is it that the two of you chose here?
My husband is born, brought up in Washington, D.C., and his mother is Japanese, and his father passed away recently, was of Indian descent, and had come to this country to be the communications coordinator with the Indian embassy. And so he came to India to teach some courses at the second largest film and television institute in Asia, and that's where I met him.
And you could have just sat back, had an easy life... Let him do all the work.
No, that's not how it goes. I think he really gave his heart, soul, and creativity to what he was doing. And I believe in true partnership. And he deserved me to put in my best. And my son, unfortunately, has Asperger's, or fortunately, I should say, because he's taught me a lot with his learning disability. And he inspired me, and we knew we really needed to work as a business team to be able to give him the best.
So we have about 30 seconds left, and there's one question I'd like you to try and answer if you can in that time. Growing up in India, your family was a very accomplished family, the way you've described a story in a green room for us.
Mm-hmm.
All of them doing things that were different.
Yes.
How are you like them, or how are you different from them? Where's the connection between what you grew up in that environment and who you are now?
Oh, absolutely. I am... it's in the genetic coding. We've got to give back to the community. And they were very community-minded, and they were very self-respecting, accomplished individuals. And that's what I think I am. I mean, that's just who I am.
So it got in the DNA.
Yes, it got into the DNA.
Thank you, Prachi. Prachi, what's the website address?
It's www.seiservices.com.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Prachi Devadas, founder and CEO of Synergy Enterprises. I'd like to thank my co-hosts for helping with the interviews today. I'd like to just tell you who our guests were again. First, we had Ban Sanawi, president and CEO of Talatech. Next up, we had Len Forkas, president and CEO of Milestone Communications. Third, we had Tim Rubin, CEO and president, USSI. And then finally, Prachi Devadas, founder and CEO of Synergy Enterprises. I'd like to then thank my co-hosts, Mike Mercurio and Mark Cohn, for helping develop our storyline and hopefully delivering to our listening audience an entertaining and educational show. And I'd like to thank our listening audience for listening. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. And you can hear more about this show again at businesstalkradio.net. Have a great day.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights Frederick, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics. Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO. Federal News Radio's DoD Wednesday. At 3, DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, a discussion with senior managers about how the department meets its mission. At 4, in-depth host Francis Rose brings you Pentagon Solutions, a smart discussion on the issues and challenges of the defense community, plus daily DoD updates, mornings and afternoons, Monday through Friday. DoD Wednesday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
This paid commercial